You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks.
Hello, and welcome to Tom Talks, the talk show where we totally talk Tom Cruise. With me today is a very special guest. He is a professional graphic designer who has a large comic book collection, and he is on a journey to find the most delicious burger of all time. Please welcome to my show, Axel Estrada. Axel, how are you doing?
Dude, I'm doing great.
You're on a journey to find the most delicious burger of all time. How has that journey gone so far? Where have you found your favorite burgers?
I think it all started when my friend took me to Little Bad Wolf in Chicago, in Uptown. No, Andersonville, around there. And it was the best burger I've ever had, so I kept that in mind, because when you had the best burger you've ever had, it sticks with you. Yeah, over time, I've just tried different ones, compared it to Little Bad Wolf. The only one that has actually put up a challenge, in my opinion, is a restaurant called Egg Slut in the West Coast.
Huh.
We went to LA and one of our friends told us about it, so we tried it. And it's basically what they do, it's just a burger, but their whole like thing is that they put an egg in it, which a lot of places do that. I don't know why it's like, but they do a really good job at having the flavor. At the same time, they also give you orange juice in like a tiny cup, and their orange juice is some of the best orange juice I've ever had.
Ooh, so, like fresh squeeze stuff, or?
I think so, yeah. I think it's like fresh, you know, straight from the oranges, you know. So if you ever find yourself in the West Coast, you know, on a hunt to kill Hitler or Bear or Bigfoot, go to Egg Slut and grab a burger there. It's amazing.
As far as burgers go, do you lean more the traditional style, like the just the basic, like pickles, onions, maybe a special sauce, or do you go for more of the novelty type burgers where it's like a big stacked burger with all sorts of toppings, a fun bun? Which kind of direction do you lean?
You know what? When I was younger, I'm saying this like I'm like 40 or 50, but when I was younger and I was a little bit more risky, I like to experiment with my burgers, you know, just get burgers that have the craziest stuff on it, stack them, do all this crazy stuff. But now I'm kind of like taking it back, you know, to like the traditional route, you know, simple, sometimes less is more, you know, simple. And with that, you can, you know, really get a sense of what the restaurant is trying to do, you know, like if at its core, it's actual good quality, or if, you know, they just say, F it, we'll do whatever we want. So, I don't know. It's interesting.
I wholeheartedly agree. I used to be the type, like, if a burger had donut buns or grilled cheese buns, I'd be like, yeah, that's great. But the more burgers I eat, the more I'm like, just that simple, like, bite of a classic tavern style or drive-in style burger. I'm just like,
Right, can't go wrong.
Let's talk about your comic book collection. I think Valkyrie, the movie today, is actually based on a comic book of the killing of Hitler, if I'm remembering correctly. Of course, the comic book is based on real life, but the director directed a ton of X-Men comics, so there's some good comic book connections here. Brian Singer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. The X-Men.
Yeah.
Movies, basically.
Yeah, so it's got this great action movie tinge to it. But what sort of comics do you collect? Any specific hero or just general?
I used to collect a lot of like DC back in high school and junior high. Superman, Batman, Nightwing. Then I went on to Marvel, but now post college, even during college, I'm more into like independent comics. I just find the stories there being more interesting because Marvel and DC get pretty repetitive with their stories and they don't take that many risks. And when they do, like let's say they kill a character, they bring him back like 12 issues later. So it's all about independent comics now. And that's kind of what I do. I mean, I end up going to multiple shops around me to find some that I need and just collecting them, because now who needs stocks when you can collect comics that end up being worth it years from now? I mean, a good example is I have the the Spider-Man Miles Morales issue number one in a variant, and I got it like years ago at Dreamland Comics in the Schaumburg area. Doesn't exist anymore, RIP, but got it there for like $15, and at the time I was like, oh, that's a lot of money for a comic, but I'll get it anyway. But now I researched it, looked it up, and now it's worth at least $100 resale. So
dang, that's
kind of, yeah,
if you let it sit, that thing will keep racking up in value.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens when, like, you know, these characters start becoming mainstream. You know, Miles Morales is now like the mainstream Spider-Man, which is so cool. Now with Marvel getting the rights to like the Fantastic Four, like I just got a Doctor Doom figure, not because I think it's cool, but also because I feel like Doctor Doom is going to be a huge villain in the MCU in the future. And if that's the case, it's going to be a lot of money on this figure here. So, you know.
Well, this is Tom Talks. So we should probably talk a little Tom.
We should. You're right.
So how familiar would you say you are with Tom Cruise's filmography?
More of his modern, like the movies that have come out after the 2000s, I know a lot about. Pre-2000s, not so much. For obvious reasons, because I wasn't born during that time. But, I mean, I've heard of them, haven't seen a lot of them. So, yeah, sadly, I like Tom Cruise. I don't know why I don't watch more of it, his movies.
Yeah, because you're definitely, in knowing you, I know you love a good action film. And his recent stuff has all been really top quality action films. His old films, there are some good action ones, but there's a lot of really weird mixed sort of movies, for lack of a better word, just a little strange. So that totally makes sense. What is your favorite Tom Cruise movie?
It would probably have to be like one of the Mission Impossible movies, at least the newer ones. Like the last three Mission Impossible movies have just been so good, you know. It would have to be one of those three, man, because the other one, I don't even know what other ones would top those in my War of the Worlds, because we talked about it.
Right.
I love War of the Worlds. I actually just rewatched it a couple of weeks ago, and it still holds up for me. I might be a little biased, but
yeah. I agree. War of the Worlds does for sure hold up. That's part of, I call it like his standalone sci-fi films. He's got War of the Worlds, Edge of Tomorrow, and Oblivion that are all pretty top quality sci-fi films. Of course, Edge of Tomorrow and War of the Worlds a little better than Oblivion, but
I still haven't seen Edge of Tomorrow or Oblivion, sadly.
Oh, you would love Edge of Tomorrow. It's a Groundhog Day, but with Emily Blunt and Tom Cruise, and they're fighting aliens in robot suits. It's an excellent.
I've only heard great things about it. I don't know why I've been pushing it off. I also heard it was based off of a manga or something. I don't really know.
You know, that sounds right. That sounds accurate. I don't actually know. A lot of Tom Cruise's stuff is based on books. He has so many that are based off of books and comic books and that kind of stuff. A few things based off of TV shows, funny enough. But that's definitely, that's one that I think you would like. What is the most Tom Cruise-y thing that you've ever done?
You know, probably the way I talk to people, because sometimes that's what Tom Cruise, the way I imagine him talking to people is just very, like, he's trying so hard to be charismatic, unintentionally, though, if that makes any sense. But just the way he comes off, he presents himself, he's always smiling, he's always, like, moving around. He's like, hey, I just imagine if I were to meet up with him, like, if I knew him, he'll be like, hey, Axel, how's it going? With that smile and the tooth going right down the middle of his face. And so that's I feel like sometimes I catch myself doing that when I talk to people sometimes. I'm trying to be all cool and stuff, but then at the end of the day, it just never never works out. It just comes off as really creepy.
I think, well, Tom Cruise comes off as really creepy. I don't think you're quite creep levels of Tom Cruise, but you do, you know, you've got the charming smile and the fun little, like, playful attitude when you meet people.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that's still Tom Cruise, so.
And then the last question, it's not really a question. It's more of a challenge. The last part of this is I am going to give you 1 minute for you to say anything that you could ever want to say to Tom Cruise. When the show is done, I'm going to supercut every single guest's minute together and have one long message that I can give to Tom if I ever meet Tom Cruise. All right, your minute to Tom starts now.
All right, Tom Cruise, you can do it all. You've proven that time and time again. And I'm wondering if Scientology has anything to do with it. Is that where you get your magic powers of being able to run miles and jump, like leap off of buildings and hang onto airplanes and stuff? Like, is that what it is? Or do you just drink kombucha 24/7? Like, I need to know your secret, Tom Cruise, because I want to do what you do. It is awesome. I want to be on top of towers and while being barefoot and just be so cool. And where do I sign up for Scientology? Just kidding. I don't want to be in Scientology. But unless that's how you get your powers, then I'll sign up right away. That's it. That's what I want to say.
That's excellent. I'm imagining him drinking kombucha 24/7. I love it. He does.
That's his serum.
Just nonstop. He does have magic powers. He, you know, he's like almost 60. Did you know that?
He is?
Yeah, no, he's like mid to late 50s.
He's older than my mom. I did not know that.
Yeah, he's 58.
That is crazy. He's 10 years older than my mom, and my mom can barely walk. So, well, I don't know what my mom is doing wrong. If Tom Cruise can.
Well, she's not a Scientologist, apparently.
Or drinking kombucha. I guess that's it, you know. Wow, that's very impressive. Yeah, man. Tom, keep doing what you're doing. He's gonna be 90, you know, doing backflips off of buildings.
Well, with that, we're going to go into a quick commercial break. After the break, we're going to play a game. So stay tuned after this.
This is Tom Skerritt for the Borgen Project. Each year, nearly 2 million children die from preventable diseases. Each day, 30,000 people die from hunger. 500 each hour are children. The Borgen Project is turning this around. We need your help. To learn more, go to BorgenProject.org. That's B-O-R-G-E-N Project.org.
Biking in Chicago is more than just a mode of transportation. It's a lifestyle. It's convenient, affordable, and with 13,000 bike racks, parking is never a problem. But with every reward comes a sidecar of risk. In Chicago, over 1,700 cyclists a year are killed or injured in bike accidents involving motor vehicles. Bike safety is simple. First, become familiar with Chicago bike laws. Know your hand signals and when to use them. Love your brain. Get a bike helmet that fits your noggin and deck it out with a headlamp and some reflective gear for riding at night. Bike at least 3 to 4 feet away from parked cars to avoid being struck by a car door being open. Motorists can do their part too by checking their side view mirrors for bike traffic before exiting their vehicle. Most importantly, remember that we're sharing the road. Looking out for both ourselves and each other is the only way to keep Chicago's roads safe, no matter what your wheels look like. For more information on bike safety in Chicago, visit www.chicagobikes.org. This public service announcement was brought to you by Radio DePaul, Chicago's College Connection.
Hello, you're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks. I'm here with Axel Estrada, and it's ethical dilemma time. Our game for today, we are going to dive into some popular ethical dilemmas, because the movie today is Valkyrie, a movie about killing Hitler. And I think my favorite ethical dilemma is, if you could go back in time, would you go back and kill baby Hitler? So I have found a BuzzFeed list of 9 moral dilemmas that will break your brain. None of them are, would you kill baby Hitler? So Axel, you and I, we're going to go back and forth reading these dilemmas, and then we'll talk about whether or not we would make these terrible decisions. So, you know,
all right.
Just a fun little conversation type game.
It's all hypothetical.
Yeah, 100% hypothetical. In no way does this reflect our actions in reality. I'll go ahead. I'll read the first one. We'll have you pick up with the second one. The first scenario is called Your Best Friend's Wedding. You're at your best friend's wedding just an hour before the ceremony is to start. Earlier that day, you come across definitive proof that your best friend's spouse-to-be is having an affair with the best man / maid of honor, and you catch them sneaking out of a room together looking disheveled. If you tell your friend about the affair, their day will be ruined, but you don't want them to marry a cheater. What do you do?
So, you have to tell them. If they're your best friend, you have to tell them. Because, their day will be ruined, but I feel like it's better to catch it and tell them now rather than letting it keep going and then it just gets worse and worse, you know? Unless the spouse is also your best friend, then you're like, well, you have to pick a favorite. Which best friend do I help out, you know?
True, true, true. Well, but if the spouse is your best friend, apparently you're the one that they're cheating on their spouse with.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's more specifications we need to know. If you are your best friend, right? If you're at your best friend's wedding, wouldn't you be there like best man or maid of honor?
So you're sleeping with the spouse.
So then you definitely don't tell your friend.
Then you don't.
You can't, because it would ruin their day and ruin your friendship. But also, I don't know. This is tricky. I think I in the case where you're not involved in their affair, you tell them, of course.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it only makes sense. But if not, you gotta look out for yourself, you know? It's all you can do in this world.
It does feel like the BuzzFeed person is experiencing this personally and wrote this article to like have a poll. So we choose tell your best friend. 87% of people chose tell your best friend.
See, it says right there. It says, sure, the day will be ruined, but better a day ruined than an entire life. Exactly.
That makes sense. 100%. All right. I'll have you read the second scenario.
All right. Robin Hood. You are an eyewitness to a crime. A man has robbed a bank, but instead of keeping the money for himself, he donates it to a poor orphanage that can now afford to feed, clothe, and care for its children. You know who committed the crime. If you go to the authorities with the information, there's a good chance the money will be returned to the bank, leaving a lot of kids in need. What do you do?
Oh, God.
What do you do, Connor? Tell me.
You know, banks are generally insured for the amount of money in their bank, and it gets replaced by the Federal Reserve in the event of a crime. I've taken far too many classes on monetary policy to care about banks. The bank doesn't need that money. They're going to get more money. So I personally would say nothing, especially since the money is now going to a good cause, because it wasn't going to in the hands of the bank.
That is true. And who knows? What if one of the kids grows up to start a bank?
That's certainly an option.
What if the bank that you robbed was in an orphanage when they were a kid?
Yeah, just
then
little, you know, little orphan Annie financial.
Dude, what if the bank is a bank that is setting up money for kids in orphanages? You know,
that's true. Like if it's a super charitable bank that donates some of the interest they receive to that same orphanage, the money was the orphanages to begin with, in which case it's fine for the robber to give it to them. I don't know.
That is true.
Yeah.
Nah, definitely. Let it be. Definitely. The kids deserve the money. And like you said, the bank will just get more money. I mean, that's how it goes, you know? So.
Okay, good. 77% of people agree.
I want to know who's the 23% that said turn the right. Those are the ones that, you know, are like, those were the teacher's pets in elementary school.
That's the thin blue line type people right there.
That definitely, yes. It definitely is.
Oh, we do not associate. Company policy. You have a job as network administrator for a company that also employs your best friend's husband. One day, your best friend's husband sends you a message asking you to release an email from quarantine. This requires you to open the email, at which point you discover that it's correspondence between this guy and his secret lover. After releasing the email, you find yourself in a pickle. Your instinct is to tell your best friend about his husband's infidelities, but divulging the contents of company email is against company policy, and you could lose your job. Once it becomes plain that your best friend found out about his cheating husband through a company email, all trails will inevitably lead to you as the leak. Do you tell him about the indiscretion?
Honestly, I gotta be honest. I hope I don't sound like a dick, but I feel like I wouldn't share and I would just keep my job, you know? Well, I think it depends on the job, but there's certain things that you just shouldn't find yourself getting wrapped up in, you know?
Yeah. Like if they're already married, we can stop a marriage. But if they're already married, nothing we can do about it.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like there's so many things. Like also, if this is a good paying job, why would I want to risk losing all that money, you know?
Feels very similar to the first one.
It does.
I have an odd feeling that this BuzzFeed writer is going through some things.
I agree. But what's interesting is that my answer to this one is different than my answer to the first one. Like, I wouldn't tell my best friend because now money's involved. And I hate to be that guy to be like, well, money this, money that. But, you know, you need to pay bills, you know, you need to eat, you know. So.
Right.
Will your best friend pay your bills and give you food?
Probably not. But like also, why are they sending like emails to their lover from their work email?
That's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they just have to be that discreet, I guess.
You know, yeah, I think I agree with you. It sucks that your best friend has a cheating husband, but you can't risk losing your job. This is very split. Voted with the minority here. 41% said no.
That is interesting. Wow. Yeah, 15% yes, you're loyal to your best friend.
That's tricky. That is a genuinely difficult moral dilemma. You know, I think I'm going to hold steadfast with where we chose.
I agree. All right.
It's sinking sensation time.
A sinking sensation. You've been on a cruise, a Tom Cruise, for 2 days when there's an accident that forces everybody on board to abandon ship. During the evacuation, one of the boats is damaged, leaving it with a hole that fills it with water. We figure that with 10 people in the boat, you can keep the boat afloat by having 9 people scoop the filling water out by hand for 10 minutes while the 10th person rests. After that person's 10-minute rest, he or she will go back to work while another person rests, and so on. This should keep the boat from sinking long enough for a rescue team to find you as long as it happens within 5 hours. You're taking your first break when you notice your best friend in a sound lifeboat with only 9 people in it, and he beckons you to swim over and join them so you won't have to keep bailing out water. If you leave the people in the sinking boat, they will only be able to stay afloat for 2 hours instead of 5, decreasing their chance of being rescued but securing yours. What do you do?
This is so... This is the weirdest one so far.
By far the weirdest. How do people come up with these scenarios?
I have no idea. Does no one have a life vest on?
Yeah, I don't... Well,
what
okay.
Math? Is that
why do you join your friend though? Is this so your friend can survive, or is your friend gonna survive anyway?
your friend's going to survive anyways. It's basically save yourself or help save the others.
And yourself.
Right. So conceivably, you don't know if the rescue crew is going to come in 5 hours' time. That's uncertain. Regardless whose boat you're on, you might not make it.
Let me see. It says, yeah, same for a rescue team to find you as long as it happens within 5 hours. I don't get why I don't get the 5 hours. Like, why is it so specific?
Apparently, if 10 people are bailing out the water, or I guess 9 people with one person resting, then you can last 5 hours. But if it's 8 people bailing out and one person resting, so 9 people total, it only lasts for 2. So one person, you account for 3 hours of the utility on this boat. Something's wrong with this.
Yeah, I don't...
You're incapable of bailing out water.
You know what? I would stay in the boat and rescue everybody, because if I'm going to survive anyway with the other people, and so is my best friend, what's the point in leaving? Just to be with my best friend? I'll be with my best friend after, when we all survive.
Yeah.
You know?
Man, we're going to Chili's after this.
Yeah, but if we lose, if we die, then we go to Wendy's.
No, that's how it goes. 68%. 32 would let them die. Conceivably. Wait, they might not die because they should have life vests.
They should, yes. They're not following protocol.
Right? Okay, time for the accidental Samaritan. You're involved in a 2-car crash on your way to work one morning in which you accidentally hit and kill a pedestrian. As you get out of the car, you are intercepted by a tearful woman who seems to think that she hit and killed the pedestrian. You're not sure why she thinks she hit the person, but she is convinced. There's only you, the woman, and the person you hit on the road. There are no witnesses. You know that whoever is deemed responsible will probably be sent to jail. What do you do?
Wow. That is dark.
Very dark. In this one, you're not trying to stop someone from dying. You've already killed them.
Crap. You know what? You can't get a lot of answers right away, right? Like, I can't walk out, go up to the woman and say, what kind of person are you? And if the woman's like, I'm a horrible person, then I'll be like, no, yeah, you take the blame. You can't do that here, because that's what I would do, right? You know, but if I did it, then I don't know. If this is happening to me right now at this age, it would be horrible to go to jail.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you got to take ownership of the things you've done, you know?
Yeah.
I can't live with all that guilt, you know? That just eats you alive. I think that's worse than going to jail and taking responsibility, in my opinion.
Yeah. And if it's involuntary manslaughter, the jail sentence isn't life, generally. It's probably, what, 10, 15 years. I would love to kind of see this play out in like an I Am Spartacus situation, where it's like you and this woman in court, like, I killed the woman, or I killed the pedestrian. No, I killed the pedestrian. You know, some dude in the back is like, I killed the pedestrian.
Yeah, I am the pedestrian.
Oh, risen.
Yeah,
probably wouldn't play out like that, but that's how I'd like to imagine it. I think, yeah, I'd have to agree with you that you don't want to live with the guilt. And in my head, she's like an old woman, right? So she's like 50 or 60. I don't know. In my head, she is. In this, she could be any age. I don't know. She could be 16.
I don't know, man. That kind of changes things if she was older. You know?
You'd let the old woman go to jail?
Well, if they're living less life than I am, you know?
Sure, I suppose.
But if I'm 50, no questions asked, I'll go. I don't care.
Yeah. I'll take over the team.
I already lived my prime time life, so.
Sure. So does that mean our answer is if she's an old woman, she can take it?
I was thinking she was like around like 30s. Maybe she has kids or something.
Okay.
Then I'll be like, all right, I'll take it because you have children who are like 2 and 3 years old, you know, and you're, you know, I don't want to do that to you. So
we're making a ton of assumptions here.
We are, yeah. They don't give us enough. BuzzFeed has to add more specificity.
True. So, yeah, we will confess. 75% of people confess. I buy it.
They're losing faith in the world.
Time for a day at the beach.
Okay.
You've got the honor.
All right, a day at the beach. Your family is vacationing alone on a private stretch of beach with no lifeguard. Your daughter and your niece, both 7, are best friends and eager to get in the water. You caution them to wait until the water calms them, but they defy you and sneak in anyway. You soon hear screams of distress and find them both caught in a strong current. You are the only swimmer strong enough to save them, but you can only save one at a time. Your niece is a very poor swimmer and likely won't make it much longer. Your daughter is a stronger swimmer, but only has a 50% chance of holding on long enough for you to come back for her. Who do you save first? Oh, God. Now I see why you brought me on to answer these questions. We would always have, like, these hypotheticals.
See, this one, they've given us so many specifics that the last one didn't give us.
They did. You're right. They did.
Right? We know that the niece isn't good at swimming. If your whole family is there, I'm a fairly weak swimmer. So if I'm the only swimmer strong enough to save them, something is wrong.
Yeah, right. Like if you're a weak swimmer, but you're the strongest because you're the only one, you're all gonna drown.
Yeah, like there is not a chance that I would be able to save one of these girls.
Girl, yeah. At that point, just save yourself. Keep the lineage going.
Yeah, I'm not even in the water in this scenario. Like I didn't come here to swim. Maybe.
Yeah, and they disobeyed you, so. That's on them.
Yeah, like where's my family? Where's my sibling? The parent of my niece to help me save these kids. Like there's more than one person here, so we can have a weaker swimmer save my daughter who's good at swimming, and I'll save my good for nothing niece.
Or since the daughter is a strong swimmer, the daughter can save the niece. And then you save the daughter. It's like a chain reaction.
Yeah, I'm also very confused. Is this a river? Is this a beach along a river?
It says, I don't know. I mean, it just says private stretch of a beach with no lifeguard.
And there's like a current in the ocean? Are ocean currents, but like they're just waves a beat towards the shore. It's not like it's, I don't know.
Unless it was in on the lake in the city, then there's not really. Well, the lake doesn't really have a lot of currents, so
true.
Or does it? I don't really know. It's a lake, so
I don't think it does.
I think I would save my niece because I have faith in my daughter and the bloodline of my daughter. Being able to power through any challenge, any obstacle. That's how I would raise my daughter.
Yeah.
And so while my daughter is like struggling, what I'm telling her will be in the back of her head that she can power through. She'll survive. I'll save the niece. And then we all go get some burgers after.
Right. They're 7 years old. You could probably get both of them, but.
True. Yeah. Unless they're on opposite sides.
I'm very confused by the whole setup of this. But yeah, we'll save the niece first. Also kind of mixed, 39% to 61%.
We are in the majority, though.
We are. Okay. We have a few more here. The spouse and the lover. You are an EMT on the scene of a car crash that involves your spouse and the lover you didn't know that they had. They are both gravely injured. Your spouse's injuries... are the worst of them. You can tell it's unlikely they will pull through. Meanwhile, their lover has a neck wound that will prove fatal if pressure isn't applied soon. Whom do you choose to work on?
This question is so funny. Imagine just working on the lover and then just letting your your spouse die, and then you and the lover are like, nice, man, let's go grab a beer.
Five.
We did it.
Yeah, I hit that. It's a car accident joke.
It's a layered joke, multiple. You know what? I think I'll work on the lover, because I think we'll be good friends. You know, I think, because what if? Okay, let me say this. What if the spouse? What if the lover didn't know that about the spouse and the spouse's husband, me, right? And the lover was just trying to have a good time, right? The spouse is the one that is, you know, going behind your back.
True. But also, what EMT travels alone? What ambulance carries only one person to save anyone's life? These are more questions that I have for the BuzzFeed writer who put together this quiz. Yeah, let's save the lover. Let's do it. 60% of people said they'd save the lover.
There you go.
Yeah.
60% of people are going to go grab a beer with the lover after. Who knows? What if you fall in love with the lover?
It could happen, you know? I think, okay, this is probably the darkest one. I'll have you read it.
Okay, a difficult decision. You and your son are prisoners at a concentration camp. Your son tried to escape but was recaptured and sentenced to hang at the gallows. To send a message to all others who may try to escape, the guard orders you to pull the chair out from under your son. If you refuse, the guard will kill your son and another innocent person in the camp. What do you do? What the f-
This is the darkest one. For sure. The thing is, I found a bunch of other clickbait lists of moral and ethical dilemmas, and this is on every list. This is a fairly popular ethical dilemma.
Why? So you either kill your son or you kill, or well, not you, but like, or your son and another innocent person dies because you didn't kill your son.
Yeah. It's a tricky one.
I think what I would do, because we're, think about it, we're at a concentration camp. What good will it do to also kill another innocent person if we're all just trying to survive? And either way, if my son is gonna die, I think I'd feel better if I did it rather than if somebody else did it. As weird as that sounds, if I have no choice, I feel like I would just try to have him understand and be like, you know, trust me, like you're with me always, this and that, and then do it myself rather than the guard or whoever being like, time to die or something, and then they just do it, and then my son, those are like the last words my son hears. So, and then you save a life. So I think, and who knows, maybe the innocent person that ends up not dying, you get with that person and then you both have another son.
It could work like that. You know, you never know. You could find love in the concentration camp.
In this scenario. So I'll pull the chair out from my son.
Yeah. I think I would probably do the same. 62% of people agree with us.
Good.
I don't understand why BuzzFeed felt the need to include that one.
Out of nowhere, just so... All right, you were comfortable in these questions. Let's just
throw this in. Your best friend's lover is revealed. Also, the Holocaust.
Yeah, right out of nowhere. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Doctor's dilemma. This is the last one. You're a doctor at a top hospital. You have 6 gravely ill patients, 5 of whom are in urgent need of organ transplants. You can't help them, though, because there are no available organs that can be used to save their lives. The 6th patient, however, will die without a particular medicine. If they die, you will be able to save the other 5 patients by using the organs of patient 6, who is an organ donor. What do you do?
I will save the other 5.
So you
like, I feel like this is, for some reason, this happens to be the easiest answer for me. And I would save the five and let the sixth one die. But I will do it in a way where I will phrase the sixth patient as a, like, as a hero. That's how, like when I tell people, you know, so then the sixth patient will live on to be on some legendary status.
Okay. Yeah. I think that makes sense. Cause like letting five people die is awful.
Right. It's like either letting people die or sacrificing someone to save those people. And I think when that is phrased that way, that sounds cooler, you know?
Yeah.
So sixth patient, kill that person. Well, not kill the, you know.
Yeah, just commit a little bit of light murder.
Right. Just like, you know, say that they're a hero and then everybody loves them after, and then the other five patients go on to win Nobel Peace Prizes, and the five patients end up bringing world peace to the world, all because of the sixth patient.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feel fairly certain that this one's going to have a pretty high, like, rate of people who would kill patient six to save the five others. Mm-hmm. I feel fairly certain it's going to be in the 80s. Oh, no.
What?
Only 36% of people said they would save the other five patients. 64% of people would let five people die and just save some schmuck.
Why? What did that sixth patient do to the 64% to have them be like, yeah, we'll save the sixth patient? That doesn't make sense. I don't know. Maybe I'm in the wrong here. Like,
I agree with you, though. I really do. I don't understand what 64% of the people who've responded to this poll. That's 147,000 people, by the way.
I want to hear their thoughts. I really want to know where they're coming from, because that is insane.
Right, there's probably something in the Hippocratic Oath that's like, yeah, you can't intentionally kill someone. I'm sure there's something in the Hip. I don't know what the Hippocratic Oath is, but I'm sure that somewhere in there, it's like, yeah, probably don't kill people.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
I haven't taken the oath.
That really surprised me, but I stand true to my choice.
Yeah.
Regardless if 147,000 people are against it, I will do it still.
Valid. Valid, valid.
There is one more question we can do.
That's true.
In the theme of Valkyrie and hypothetical questions. If you had a 10-inch clone of Hitler, would you torture it?
You know, it depends on the canonness of clones. And this, we've talked about this before. We've talked about this for hours on end.
Yes, we did.
If he's still a Nazi, right? Like, if the clone still holds the beliefs of a Nazi, I think, yes, I would torture the 10-inch clone of Hitler. But if the clone doesn't share the same beliefs, he just has the same genetic makeup as Hitler. Like, if he's like Hitler's cool 10-inch twin brother, right? Like
Hitler with shades and stuff.
Right. You know, he smokes cigarettes and eats red meat. Things that I don't think Hitler did.
And is cool with, you know, Jewish people.
Right. Like he's hip with the times, you know. I wouldn't torture that dude because he's chill. He's 10 inches. Like,
yeah,
he can't help what his brother's politics are, but if he shares the same beliefs, I'll torture any Nazi, 10 inches or no.
You know what, you know, me too. I agree 100%. I would do the same, especially if it's 10 inches. Why not, you know?
Right?
Yeah, I guess it all depends on its beliefs. So I'm already like dehumanizing.
Yeah, it's a 10-inch Hitler clone. We are allowed to dehumanize it.
That is true. Yeah, anything with Hitler, we can dehumanize.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's easy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's easier than any of these BuzzFeed moral dilemmas.
Yeah, right.
A Nazi's a Nazi, no matter how small.
True.
Well, yeah, that was our game. That was ethical dilemma time. I want to give you an opportunity on the show to promote what you're doing. I know as a graphic artist, you've got a fun little art shop going. I see you're wearing one of your hoodies. I really dig your hoodies. Give your social media, give yourself a little shameless promo.
So, hello. My social media is Axestrada, AXESTRADAA. I sell prints and clothes. I just dropped a line recently, Corazon line. It's over. I don't know why I'm promoting that because it's done. I'm not making those anymore, but I am going to be making new stuff soon. A lot of stuff this year. I'm excited. And most of the time, like 90% of the time, I have free shipping. So there you go. Hop on, you know, check it out if you can.
Oh, yeah.
Support your local artists.
But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm happy because we've talked about it, and I'm happy I'm finally here and it can be a part of it.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, thanks for coming on. We're going to go into a song break. And then after the song break, we're going to do fast facts, fun facts, and data breakdown after this. Hello, and we are back. You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks. That was Ride of the Valkyries by Wagner. And today we're talking about Tom Cruise's movie, Valkyrie. Let's get into a synopsis, some fast facts, fun facts, and a data breakdown, starting with a synopsis. During World War II, Wehrmacht Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg is stationed in Tunisia, where he becomes increasingly disillusioned with the future of Germany under Hitler's tyranny. His battalion comes under attack by P-40 fighter bombers of the No. 3 Squadron RAAF Desert Air Force. Stauffenberg is severely injured in the air raid and is evacuated home to Nazi Germany. Meanwhile, Hitler visits his military headquarters on the Eastern Front. General Henning von Treskow attempts to assassinate Hitler by smuggling a time bomb disguised as a box of Cointreau onto his plane. The bomb fails to detonate, and Hitler's plane lands safely in Berlin. Shortly afterwards, resistance member General Hans Oster is arrested by the Gestapo. While recuperating, Stauffenberg is recruited by General Friedrich Ulbricht to take Oster's place in the German resistance, which includes Treskow, General Ludwig Beck, Dr. Karl Gerdeler, and Field Marshal Erwin von Wilsbleben. I'm going to mispronounce a ton of names today, and I'm fine with that. Stauffenberg proposes using Operation Valkyrie, which involves the deployment of the reserve army in a national emergency, as a means to take control of the country. The plotters redraft the plan's orders to dismantle the Nazi regime after assassinating Hitler. Stauffenberg's new role within the reserve army grants him direct access to Hitler, who approves the redrafted plan without fully examining modifications. Realizing that only General Friedrich Fromm, the head of the reserve army, can initiate Valkyrie, they offer him a position as the head of the Wehrmacht, but Fromm declines to be directly involved. Stauffenberg is ordered to assassinate both Hitler and Himmler at the Wolf's Lair. He persuades General Feldgebel to cut off communications after the attempt. On July 15, 1944, Stauffenberg attends a strategy meeting at the Wolf's Lair with a bomb, but does not receive permission to proceed as Himmler is absent. Meanwhile, the reserve army is mobilized by Ulbricht. Stauffenberg leaves with the bomb, and the reserve army is ordered to stand down. Fromm threatens Ulbricht and Stauffenberg that he will arrest them if they try to control the reserve army again. Stauffenberg berates the plotters for their indecisiveness and condemns Gerdeler. When Gerdeler demands that Stauffenberg be relieved, Beck informs him that the SS has issued a warrant for his arrest and that he must leave the country immediately. On July 20th, 1944, Stauffenberg and his adjutant, Lieutenant Heifden, return to the Wolf's Lair. Due to the warm weather, the conference is being held in an open-window summer barrack, minimizing their bomb's potential effectiveness. Stauffenberg places the briefcase containing the bomb close to Hitler before leaving. Officer Heinz Brandt moves the case behind a table leg, inadvertently shielding Hitler. When the bomb explodes, Stauffenberg is certain that Hitler is dead and flees, managing to bluff his way past security checkpoints and return to Berlin. Ulbricht refuses to mobilize the reserve army without confirmation that Hitler is dead. Colonel von Kuernheim, one of the plotters, forges his signature, and issues the orders. With Valkyrie underway, the plotters order the arrest of Nazi party leaders and SS officers, convincing lower officers that the party and the SS are staging a coup, and soldiers begin to take control of the ministries. Rumors surface that Hitler survived the blast, but Stauffenberg dismisses them as SS propaganda. Having learned from Field Marshal Keitel that Hitler is still alive, Fromm refuses to join the plotters, resulting in detaining them. Major Otto Ernst Rimmer of the Reserve Army prepares to arrest Goebbels, but is stopped when Goebbels connects him by phone to Hitler. Recognizing the voice on the other end, Rimmer realizes that the Reserve Army has been duped. SS officers are released, and the plotters are besieged inside the Bender Block. The headquarters staff flees, but the resistance leaders are arrested. Attempting to save himself, Fromm conceives of an impromptu court-martial, places Beck under arrest, and sentences von Quirnheim, Ulbricht, Heichten, and Stauffenberg to death. The ringleaders are executed by firing squad. Beck is given a pistol and commits suicide, and Treskow commits suicide in a forest by holding a grenade to his throat. Witzelblin and Gerdler are sentenced by Roland Freisler in show trials and hanged. A postscript displays the text of the German Resistance Memorial. Now, this movie's based on a true story. This all technically actually happened. Of course, in the true story, not everyone had British accents. They were actually speaking German. And this movie actually starts with Tom Cruise speaking a monologue in German and writing in German, and then it slowly fades into English, which I think is so funny as a way to explain why all of these Nazis have British accents. And I'll tell you one fun fact early. Only one non-German actor was given permission to use a German accent, and that was the actor who played Hitler, because the filmmakers didn't want Hitler to have a British accent. And I just think that's a little funny. Let's get into the fast facts. It was directed by Bryan Singer, who directed the X-Men series, as well as Bohemian Rhapsody and The Usual Suspects. It was written by Christopher McQuarrie, a phenomenal writer who also wrote Usual Suspects, several of the Mission Impossible films, and Edge of Tomorrow. Also with a writing credit was Nathan Alexander, who has written virtually nothing else. The cast, Major Henning von Treskow is played by Kenneth Branagh from Dunkirk, All Things Shakespeare, Road to El Dorado, and Harry Potter. General Friedrich Ulbricht is played by Bill Nye, who, of course, you know from Pirates of the Caribbean, Love Actually, Detective Pikachu. Friedrich Fromm is played by Tom Wilkinson, who, you know, was in the Grand Budapest Hotel and a John Adams miniseries where he played Ben Franklin, always very fun. Nina von Stauffenberg, who is the wife of Tom Cruise's character, is played by Clarice von Houten from Game of Thrones and Repo Man. Ludwig Beck is played by Terrence Stamp, who plays General Zod in Superman and also Chancellor Valorum in Star Wars Episode I Phantom Menace. So 10 out of 10 to Terrence Stamp. I didn't know his name before today. General Eric Feligubu, I can't pronounce any of these names, can I? Is played by Eddie Izzard, who is known for Ocean's 13, Across the Universe, the Green Eggs and Ham series, and Cars 2. And, you know, Hitler is played by David Bamber, who is also in Enola Holmes and Harry Potter and Bourne Identity. So we've got a couple Harry Potterers here, a couple of famous British actors on the whole. Very exciting. Other fun facts, Mythbusters actually recreated the scene in this movie because a lot of people believed that if Hitler had stayed in the bunker and not come above ground, he would have actually died in this assassination attempt. But that is actually not the case. Mythbusters tested it and found that he wouldn't have died either way. The bomb wasn't strong enough and the chairleg was in the way. This script was part of the 2007 Blacklist, which is a list of scripts that people like but haven't been made yet. So it was one of the scripts that people really liked from 2007, but nobody made. So they made it in 2008. And then Germany actually didn't let them film at any military bases because Tom Cruise is a Scientologist, and they thought it would be dangerous to let someone in such a powerful cult to have access to their military bases. So, you know, just Tom things pretty much. I'll go into a little bit of a data breakdown for you. As you know, I rate all these movies on enjoyment, engagement, quality, iconography, and the Tom Cruise factor. This movie, it's a very middle-of-the-road kind of movie. I didn't enjoy it very much. I wasn't very engaged. kind of mid-level quality, not iconic at all. Pretty Tom Cruise-y though. Tom Cruise leads an assassination attempt on the worst dictator known to man. So it got a total compound score of 50 for me, 50 out of 100. So not great. It's about the same as Lions for Lambs. I just didn't enjoy it is the main thing. It had a lot of potential as an action movie, great writer, great director, but it's hard to get over that opening sequence where he's writing in German and speaking in German and then slowly fades into English. It's just so funny to me. But yeah, that's just about all the time that I have for Tom Talks today. Thank you so much for listening. Tune in next week for my Night and Day episode. And as always, stay gold, Pony Boy.